Counter Contemporary Art is pleased to welcome you to Discuss 7. Talking with us today, we have artist Mark Bennett, whose show of architectural renderings from famous movie homes is currently on view at the gallery. We also have with us Zoe Charlton, whose work deals with race and identity. Mark and Zoe will be discussing their work and how their upbringings in the South play into the work that they create.
Today we have with us Mark Bennett and Zoe Charlton, who are going to discuss drawing and being Southern.
Yeah.
So anyway, with no further ado, Mark, tell us a little bit about your current exhibition you have here.
Well, this is my Valentine's to the movies, my favorite movies. We have six different drawings that I create, usually using a VCR, usually one from the Goodwill store, because I blow them out like once a month. And I always say you watch a movie 65 times, you finally get it. The list here, we have Virginia Woolf, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and we have Rosemary's Baby, Gone with the Wind, which I said I would never do until I watched the movie and fell in love with it and thought it was incredible. We have Streetcar Named Desire and Sunset Boulevard and Boogie Nights, which is the most current thing I've done. I don't really like new movies. I like usually like older movies, especially from the 50s. I usually go back to 51 and then I just pretty much go forward. But the last time I did a show here 3 years ago, I had done some obscure ones like Autumn Leaves, and people really don't understand certain obscure movies. But I try to give something that people could relate to more, which would be more popular films, and something that I could still enjoy. Even though they were popular, they were very good, and something I really wanted to do. So I usually start with an idea of, say, let's do Rosemary's Baby, for example. New York apartment, Dakota. We know it's in the Dakota because they go into the to look at the apartment with the manager, and then he starts to explain about the apartment. It's four rooms, the original back 10 of 7D, and now you're in 7E. Actually, what I do is do it in pencil on graph paper, or maybe even do it on a sketch pad and list things about each movie character or each thing that happens in this movie, and make a list of all the people, all the characters involved, because I like to put all the characters on the paper somehow. Elise Dunstan was her best friend in Rosemary's Baby, and of course she's not in the apartment during the party, but I wanted to include her somehow. So on the phone next to her bed, I put call to Elise Dunstan, because I want to remember in my head that was her best friend. Now, some people think, you know, get a life, this is not that interesting. But to me, it's like this trivia that just sends me to the moon. And when you have this kind of energy focused on something like that, to me, it is absolutely important to include all this stuff. I'm assuming there's no other way to describe it.
Zoe, tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, my work is, I make drawings too. I use a bunch of different types of imagery. So I use Klan hoods and blackface and whiteface and picket fences and pink suburban houses. You know, it's so funny because you said we were talking earlier that you're from suburbia, and I would say that I'm a suburbanite, and I am.
Yeah.
That's all I know. And so they range. My work ranges in sizes from 9x12 to larger drawings. I don't know what size that one is that you have.
About 5 by 4 feet.
Something like that. And it's it's a graphite on paper. Why do you start with 1951 in particular? What is it about the way that those movies look?
Most of the things about the movies that attracted me so much was cars, the cars, the clothing. The actors, I'm really crazy about that era, and it moved forward. For some reason, I wasn't around until 56, so I'm assuming the reason why 51 is so important was that was the year of All About Eve, and it was the year of a whole bunch of movies that came out all that one year. I am crazy about that visual look. I stay away from war movies, and I don't really care for movies about political espionage or anything like that. But anything that has to do with characters who wear charm bracelets or have cocktail glasses going or have a really, really chic apartment. I have friends I'll call up and go, did you see that movie? I'll Cry Tomorrow with Susan Hayward, and her apartment is just incredible. And I think that's the reason why focus on certain elements of the story and the visuals.
Now, interestingly enough, I've only known two people to ever mention the movie Imitation of Life to me, and you're both sitting here on the couch talking to each other at this point. Can you guys talk a little bit about what that movie meant to you and in terms of your artwork? Because I know you bring different things to it. Because
right.
we showed Imitation of Life 3 years ago here.
Right.
And you were recently speaking at the Hirshhorn with Iona Brown, and you were talking about that. So
I love that movie. It's actually my mom's favorite movie as well. And so she watched it every year without fail. And I remember never wanting to do that because I thought, I'm not going to watch this movie. It's in black and white. Why would I want to do that? You know, and it wasn't until a few years ago that I sat down. I was home one day, couldn't leave the house, and I thought, this is so beautiful. And I was so interested in Piola, you know, just this idea that someone wanted to pass. And I don't have anybody in my family that has passed or wanted to pass, but it was a real interesting idea, and I kept thinking, Piola's trying to do this. She's actually doing it for other reasons. I mean, it was a subversive activity, and I was really interested in passing as a subversive activity, and how can I represent that in a piece? And I thought, well, you know, the most extreme way to do that is, why not dress up a black woman in a Klan hood? That's passing.
Mm.
You know, and it became a sort of interesting sort of idea of how Piola can be interpreted, you know, interpreted, and just this idea for Piola to have a lot of self-hatred, and then also this sort of femininity, and in my drawings, she's trying to, you know, these women are kind of prancing around or dancing around or tiptoeing through the grass. So there's one that's called Splendor. It's like Splendor in the grass. And then there's, you know, they're doing all these other things, and there's a lot of sort of kind of sexuality in these drawings. And so, but they're all about Piola because, you know, when Piola's working at the department store, you know, the way that she looks, she's very charming, she's very attractive, you know, and I thought, well, God, that's pretty amazing. She's acting a certain way, and she's passing as white, and then her mom, you know, then your mom walks in and says, oh my God, I think that that's Piola. You know, it's a real sort of strange thing, so that's one of the reasons why I love that movie. It's actually generated a whole body of work based on that. All the Undercover series are primarily about Piola.
I'm crazy about that.
Yeah.
You actually made a whole series of work based on that movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a very powerful movie myself. I just thought the whole thing was pretty incredible.
You know, I also like it because I kind of nickname it the Aunt Jemima story. You know, it's just such a strange sort of phenomenon. And every time I look at that, I thought, gosh, I wonder if that's Jemima, you know, I wonder if that's really her. And it's so strange to have, you know, the syrup bottle and you know, Mrs. Butterworth and Aunt Jemima pancakes, and then have this black and white film that speaks directly about that idea of someone benefiting from someone else's work. And even when the other person that's working still benefits in some other way. I mean, so it was a real strange sort of thing. I think that that work does a lot of things that I want my drawings to do, that movie does a lot of things that I want my drawings to do. I love that. Just love it.
And create emotion.
Yeah.
Just like that movie did.
Yeah.
That was a three-tissue movie, by the way.
Yeah,
wasn't it? Oh, I mean, you know, you're just like boo-hooing and
the entire time.
Yeah, and she's trying to pass, and then the mother's sick, and she goes to that Moulin Rouge in Hollywood, and her daughter's
exactly.
a showgirl.
Right.
And she's telling her roommate, this is not my mother, this
mm-hmm.
is my maid.
This is my
and
maid.
And you're thinking,
oh my God. Oh, my God.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah,
pretty incredible.
Is.
If you haven't watched it, go see it.
You've got to see the end when mom dies.
Oh.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That was pretty painful.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
How did that come out in your drawing, Mark? You decided, you know, for your first round of movie homes, that you would draw that. Why?
The biggest tackle. I always pick them out. A movie like Boogie Nights is a real house somewhere in the San Fernando Valley. I don't want to know where it is. I have never been there. When I did Imitation of Life, I know it's a movie set. I know they use the exterior shot where they pull up in the limo is heart to heart. The TV show, Heart to Heart, the exterior.
Yeah.
It's very brief, but they show it as an introduction into her new home in Connecticut.
Yes.
And here's Annie, and here's Lana Turner, walking around this incredible house. It was an eight-sided living room with beams that shot out from angles above this massive, like, slate fireplace. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you turn that into a real drawing, knowing that it's a movie set? Mm-hmm. And that was my challenge. I thought, I'm going to see if I can't make that into a real house, because some of the rooms did not match. There's no way they could have this back staircase here and have the kitchen over here. But to turn it into a real drawing was the whole point of it. And I think the more convoluted, the more confusing they are, the better the drawing is visually. To see, like, Sunset Boulevard being a house that never could... Well, we know they used the exterior of a house that was going to be torn down. They used it in Sunset Boulevard, and they used it in Rebel Without a Cause. And then it was destroyed. But it was an abandoned house they used in Hollywood. So you read this in these books on Hollywood, and you find out they obviously built a set that was the actual making of Sunset Boulevard. But when Lee told me that one was sold, I thought, oh, no, that's a do-over. Because actually, I wanted to change some doors around, and I wanted to change some of the things that I had thought about later that could be fixed better. Mm-hmm. But you can't do that because you just keep going on and on, and you can't focus on other work. So you let it go, and you realize this is my interpretation right now of what Sunset Boulevard would look like as a real house. Mm-hmm. That was the whole trip of all these drawings, is to make them look like real houses, to make them be like a living space that you could actually go into and live in and enjoy them. You know, as real houses.
Is there one that you would live in?
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby's apartment. I think because it's more realistic, as far as it probably really was an apartment. I don't think they went into the studio to shoot maybe a couple of scenes, but basically that was somewhere in Manhattan, an apartment. It probably was in the Dakota, and they probably arranged it so they could shoot. But the, like I said, Virginia Woolf, that was probably an exterior shot of a house on campus in somewhere in New England. And they probably built the set at Warner Brothers to because it was obviously it was a closed set, and they built it on the soundstage and created this ambiance of a professor's a house on campus. And Streetcar Named Desire was built on Warner Brothers lot, and that was a closed set because they had a lot of people coming to visit. I love it that they had these stars. You read about these stars, like Joan Crawford was shooting Autumn Leaves over on this soundstage. So she goes over to visit because she liked Marlon Brando, and they had to tell her to go home because they were really concentrating on getting this film done. And the way they would shoot the reason why Sunset Boulevard, the apartment is so claustrophobic, is they would take a wallpaper and run it through coffee to make it look old, and then they would hang it on the wall and then bend it so it would look have a crease in it, and they said they'd make the room almost sweat. And that kind of stuff to me is just fascinating. I would never even think there's somebody out there who's thinking up this stuff to take floral wallpaper, drain it in coffee, and then put it on the wall.
I don't want to hear that. That's the trick.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel about those tricks?
I'm devastated by those tricks. When somebody says to me, you know, I can get you on the back lot and you can see all these properties. Most of these properties are destroyed after they're built. I found out that the Cosby Show, the staircase in the Cosby Show, was actually Archie Bunker's staircase. What they do is when they finish with a TV show, they don't destroy the set. They ship it off to the valet in a big storage locker. Mm-hmm. And like the Golden Girls was a three, they called it a swing set, living room, lanai, kitchen. Mm-hmm. And those three are the principal ones. But when they finish with that show, they'll ship it off to the valley in a storage locker, and then they'll bring it back and alter it for someone else's show. Because it's too expensive to build that stuff.
Oh,
if you remember that ornate staircase in the Cosby Show,
yeah.
The foundation of that is actually Archie Bunker's staircase. But it's been, because Dr. Cosby was so incredibly wealthy that it was a very ornate staircase, but that was basically the foundation for that.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. So all this, also the staircase from Maud?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Oh,
actually,
God.
It's used in a lot of shows, and it kind of breaks your heart to find out that when you actually go and visit these places, they're much smaller,
mm-hmm.
they're much less grand, and you feel like I'd rather remember it from what I see on the TV. You know, that's like a motto of mine is what I saw on the TV instead of what it really looks like in real life.
You were talking earlier about how you figure out how large rooms are,
mm-hmm.
by the way that you would count how many
right.
steps it took for one of the characters to get to the other side of the room.
Right.
Why? I mean, you know, it's so interesting because I thought, well, does it make it more believable for you, or do you, you know, why not just say that's a 12 by 12 room and the bathroom is probably, what's the average size of the bathroom?
I think a lot of it is being a purist and trying my best to do it without knowing any information about it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the Streetcar Named Desire house, it was built on a 12 by 20. Each room was supposed to be 12 by 20. Mine are not 12 by 20. They're a little bit off. That's okay. It's more about the drawing and the way it would fit on the paper that you try to make it, manipulate it. And the same with the TV houses or even the movie houses. You figure out, okay, they have this much room to play with. I have a real problem with Rosemary's Baby because there's two closets, but next to the kitchen. And there's something behind that little bar area that had to be a pantry because there's no way they could have... She walks 8 steps to that doorway, and there's no way to have 8 steps at that much length to go without having something beside those closets. And those closets would not be that deep, but it all fit together. And I think I had the biggest problem with that particular area in that house. And also, since the Cassavetes lived next door, and they were actually the back of her apartment, and she actually goes through there to find Satan's baby... How much do you include of the Cassavetes apartment to make it more believable?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking, okay, in this drawing particularly, visually on the paper, we're not going to give too much because it's going to look lopsided. If I went all crazy and put mini Cassavetes kitchen in, we would have a whole different ball game. It's basically focused on Guy and Rosemary's apartment, not about the Cassavetes, even though the Cassavetes apartment does become part of the story. I wanted to make sure that you had just a hint, and that's why the rest is blank. I just wanted a hint of their apartment and focus mainly on Guy and Rosemary's living quarters. And I'm crazy about the way they decorated it. Painted it all white, had brand new furniture brought in from Sloan's. Probably 65 was when they shot that. Actually, the movie was shot in 69. It was supposed to take place in 65. So I found it really not only a great movie. I've done drawings of movies that were not so great, and people are like, why don't you do that? And I think a lot of it's because of something personal. Or something rare, like Female on the Beach. It's not released. Columbia's got it all tied up in red tape. You can't get Female on the Beach. But if you have a friend that has TiVo, you can record it. And then he gives you a copy. You take it to your recorder, and you record a copy of it for yourself. And it's this incredible beach house in Newport Beach. And the movie's kind of a stinker. But it's
after all that trouble,
but it's a visual thing, and of course I'll do it for me. I mean, nobody has to see it, but I'd love to see what it looked like on paper.
Mm-hmm. Zoe, do you do things just for yourself? Do you do drawings
all the time
that just stay with you
all the time? I have stacks and stacks and stacks of just stuff, and sometimes they turn out to be something really significant. And it's so interesting because even all those undercover drawings were. It's just a body of work that I was just doing in response to Imitation of Life, and I didn't think that they would really go anywhere. You know, I didn't expect them to, and so that they were kind of fun to do. You know, and you know, okay, what else can I do? Can I put a ship sail on somebody coming out of somebody's, you know, frilly underwear? Or, you know, what else? They were, you know, at some point they're kind of amusing, and sometimes they're kind of risky and. I have tons of stuff just sitting around the studio that I don't think might do anything. And so it's really surprising when somebody comes in and they're kind of looking around because the studio in general is a mess. Well, I'm sure yours is, right? And so when somebody comes in and they start leaping through things, and just recently someone was in there and pulled a stack of drawings out, like 20 drawings, and it's paper from the Ann Hamilton at hand. You know, that fell onto the floor. And so I did all these drawings on them. And she pulled, and I hadn't seen them for a few months, but she went through and lifted stuff and had to stack up collages and drawings and started going through them, and she really liked them. And I was surprised because I just kind of did them.
Right.
And just, you know, set them aside.
Right, but they do affect you.
Yeah.
And they affect your later work.
Exactly, they do.
If you don't ever do anything with them, they do affect what's going to be later.
Because in that one, there's one where, because the hand paper is frosted, and it's got a really nice kind of burgundy brown border that's fuzzy. And so I have it's an image of a fairly kind of large man, and it looks like he's wrapped in wrapping paper.
Mm-hmm.
and he's tied up. So it's kind of a strange, like, Christmas present bondage sort of image, and it's and he's put on the back of this frosted paper, and I love it. And so it was just really, it was really interesting because I love this, the idea of it being at hand and it's a very soft thing, and then you have this sort of really intense image going on in the back of it that you can only see it, you know, you can really understand it or see the image when you tilt it a certain way. So it's really, I like those. I really like that work. So it, you know, and it shocks me because now, you know, I started looking at that after she'd been looking at them, and I thought, oh, that would be interesting to have figure like that, maybe, you know, larger, interacting with someone else, and I would never, so it's so strange how they all become these sort of weird journal sort of things that that,
right.
that start to combine in different ways, but yeah, tons of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
But you want to keep it for yourself.
Yeah.
Like private.
Yeah. You know, and so that's, the other thing is when she came in and started looking at them, I was kind of...
You slap her hand?
I don't know if I want to talk about that. And it was really, it was a strange sort of thing because I, there's, like, I've got stuff on the walls that are pinned and that are in a pile, and they're all the kind of the rejects. Because when you came in, I said, oh, those are all rejects. No, can't look at those. And it's so, it's really curious because they're sort of like these intimate sort of recordings and or hidden things, and you think, oh, they're mine, just kind of seal them away and... No, I don't know.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. When you release these to the gallery and to the viewer,
they're no longer
yours.
Exactly.
That sort of feeling of incredible
mm-hmm.
possessiveness
mm-hmm.
on something that you, before released,
yeah.
once it's in the frame, once it's in a gallery showing, it really becomes part of the public domain.
It does.
And
it
it's
does.
No longer, it doesn't have that,
mm-hmm.
that incredible sense of secrecy and privacy.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
my drawings were under the bed for 20 years where I ever showed any of the blueprints
mm-hmm.
of the TV shows. And somebody saw them
mm-hmm.
in New York under my bed and said, what are these? And I remember saying, no, those are private. And closing the lid on the drawing template.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, these are too, I can't share this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's time when it's time
yeah.
for you to share this
mm-hmm.
with the world. And you know.
Yeah.
But having little things put away,
exactly.
I'm with it totally.
Totally. I said a southern thing. We were talking a little bit about this earlier. You're from Tallahassee and you're from Chattanooga.
Uh-huh.
And how do you think that informs your work, Mark?
I think it's very important to remember growing up in the South and not having a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Our parents who didn't have a lot of money for things. I remember being so embarrassed. Our car was 20 years old. You know, and it didn't have power windows. It didn't have air. You know, that those kind of things when you're a kid. Like, well, if I could just be with those people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What it does is... you create this fantasy world, and these drawings came from that
mm-hmm.
fantasy world, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what that's a coping skill.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up in that kind of environment and not being happy and feeling kind of like a middle kid and not having a lot of attention, I think I went into zeroed in on the fantasy part to create these drawings. Now, it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had the environment I was in. So you have to count it up as sort of a great little coping mechanism
mm-hmm.
to make the work.
Mm-hmm.
If you had grown up in a different environment...
Oh, there's absolutely no way I'd be making the same work as
thank you.
At all. And a lot of the subject matter comes from those years of living there and family that is from, you know, that's still living there. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. I was going to tell you this story earlier. My mom and I were going shopping. I was probably about 15, 16 years old, and we went to Monticello,
yeah.
which is right outside of Tallahassee. And we walked in, and this really hit me, and this is actually one of the first times that I really thought, my mom is a badass. She's kind of cool. So we walked into this antique store, and the proprietor was an older white woman who said, how can I help you girls today? And my mom turned around and said, how old do I need to be before you call me a woman? And we walked out, and I thought, yes, that was awesome. And I keep thinking, like, that sort of attitude there. I you know, I was like, I want that in my work. But I have these experiences like that. And, like, I have a series of work that specifically about my grandmother. You know, she had 9 kids, and she took care of the Jones, a white family, for 40 years or something like that. And, you know, and it's interesting because if I wasn't from the South, didn't have family from the South, none of this work would I wouldn't be doing it in this work. And if I did, I wouldn't be connected to, you know what I mean? So there's a real sort of, it's really important for me to do that, this work about sort of the Southern culture, you know, or things that happen there, and about family that still lives there.
Right.
So, and the sorts of, you know, difficulties or issues with racism and with gender and with class that
right.
are associated with living in the South. So, yeah, if I hadn't had any experiences there, there's no way. I don't know what I would be doing if I had lived in, I don't know, New Jersey all my life.
Right, but you do see it from people from New Jersey. They don't have the share that share that same claustrophobic.
You know, I was talking to someone recently.
Kind of feeling.
Exactly, I was talking to someone about from North Carolina about porch culture. You know, it's like, you know, if somebody's sitting on their porch, if they have their back to you and they're sitting on the porch, that you don't go up. But if they're sitting and reading, you can go onto the porch, and if you're facing it, you can say, hey, and you're really friendly. And it's really interesting because that sort of porch culture does not exist in the North. You know, like even in the North, like people don't just like walk up to somebody. So you don't walk up and knock on the door and say, can I borrow that, unless
right.
you really know them.
Right.
But as soon as you know, you get past a certain point, like in Richmond, you can do that. But as soon as I started moving, traveling as an adult, going back into the South, I started noticing, like, there are certain things, like people would invite me in for tea, like sweet tea, not, you know, hot tea.
Right.
And it was so interesting. I love that sort of thing. But yeah, being Southern is, it's a really important thing. Matter of fact, when I took the job that I did, someone said to me that I was going to go, I was going to move back to Florida. And they said, oh, Zoe, you don't want to go this, you don't want to go that far down past the Mason-Dixon line. Don't do that. You want to stay farther north. And it's such an interesting sort of thing to say.
Right.
And I remember being so offended. So I was so angry. I thought, what's wrong with Southern culture? What's wrong with being from the South?
Right. And plus, your family is one of the oldest families
in
Tallahassee.
Both my families are two of the oldest families in Tallahassee. One is around the sort of Lake Jackson area, and the other one is around the fairgrounds. And so, and I was telling you, my parents met, they went to the segregated high school. That's where they met. And everyone that's in my parents' age all know each other. You know, so I look like my mom, and people will say, aren't you Lucille's child? Yes.
Oh, that's kind of nice.
Yes, I am.
See, since you're not there, you don't get that.
When I go back, I do.
You get it, yeah.
So it's interesting. Yeah.
They call you Miss Zoe?
No, they don't.
I get called Miss Lee, and it's just really upset.
No,
it means you've reached a certain age. You get called Miss Mark.
I'd love that. That'd be great.
I think we're sort of running out of time here. Did anybody have any questions? For these guys?
Actually, I have a comment about your work. First, I see the drawings, so it didn't do anything to me.
Uh-huh.
They were very cold and I was distanced to them.
Right.
But then, the more that I paid attention to the details, they started to create this narration that you're so interested in as well. You're very interested in the stories and almost telling a story based on another creative work. So, a very simple, sort of, in the beginning, excuse my language, boring-looking drawing, all of a sudden becomes really interesting, and you start to associate things with it, and then you start to make stories of your own. So you're also giving a lot of room to the audience to put their imagination into it.
Oh, thank you. That's great. Thank you.
So, I mean, there is a delay in your work, but, you know, you have to spend just a little bit of time and then you get into the work.
Okay. Oh, great.
Have you ever thought about really, really dealing with classical narration in your work, in your drawings?
As far as storytelling?
Yes.
Yeah.
As far as storytelling.
I'm doing storytelling now on a period of work that I found out of clippings of newspapers, obscure clippings of newspapers, stories like a man using a payphone in Tallahassee. This made the newspaper. This man's using the payphone. No, the man walks up to use the payphone. A 16-year-old girl is on the payphone. She won't get off. And he says, excuse me, how long are you going to be on the phone? She takes a beer bottle, breaks it in half, and stabs him. He says, now we have an assault here. He calls the cops. The cops come, and the girl's still talking on the phone. It's only about, you know, this big, a newspaper clipping like that. I blew it up this big. But what I'm going to do is put it on graph paper. Now the trick is to cut out each one of the newspaper lettering to create this floating dialogue on top of something else that I'm creating, which is pencil drawings underneath it. That would be my narrative. But as far as classical, I don't know if you call that classical, but that to me just hit me like a ton of bricks. The lady, the lady sleeping in the car goes through the window and into her bed. You know, and she's alive and nobody's hurt.
Right.
Obscure little clippings is what I'm thinking of in terms of dialogue. And then I had done these drawings of high school kids talking about their tragic love affairs, right? And then have in red ink what the teacher would do to correct their bad punctuation or spelling. And have those in these. I had done this show with huge, huge frames. Cost a fortune. The show, nothing sold. So I took those frames and cut them down. So now I have 12 new, incredibly ornate frames to play with, but they're all weird sizes. To get the 4x8 down, he could cut them in half or cut them in threes. So now I have like a whole dozen, and that to me is freedom. It's like now you have, oh my God, now I have 12 new beautiful frames that I had to recreate. I can recreate something else. That's where those messages are going to go. Mm-hmm. Those dialogues.
How did he call?
He wanted to.
Oh,
he was asking to use the phone.
He didn't call. She was taken away. From what I gather, the thing was so concisely beautiful, the way it was written. 16-year-old girl on the phone, breaks a beer bottle, stabs him. He says, now we have an assault here. When the police came, she was still on the phone.
Oh, okay. I thought he called
them. Yeah, no, I love that whole concept of hardened juvenile delinquents. I just think they're... I remember being in junior high school, and my cousin named Twig, who married the hoodiest girl in my junior high school, and she had bleached bangs.
Wow.
Bleached, you know, down here, hoodie bang, you know, and of course he died when he was 18 in a car wreck, and they were running from the police or whatever, but, you know, that's where I come from. I mean, it's amazing to me that my mother comes to these things sometimes and she starts to cry. But it had only been different. You wouldn't have done I said, Mother, if I hadn't done these drawings, I wouldn't be here right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's let it go. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that I couldn't fit into your shoes and you didn't fit into mine. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I disappointed her terribly. But, you know, as payment, I took them to the Greenbrier with my father and her as a payment for
this
all.
This is also a Southern thing.
It was also very Southern. My brother goes, I wouldn't spend 10 minutes in the car with those people. And I'm like, you don't understand. I don't want to hate them anymore.
Uh-huh.
So taking them to the Greenbrier for 4 days was like my payment for painting the living room purple when they went to church. You know? or doing those horrible things that we all do as kids. Just, you know, the disco music is blaring and she's going, could you possibly turn that now? You know, those kind of things, being a rebellious teenager, just a hell on earth. And I think, I just remember being so angry. Angry.
Yeah.
You know, at the world and about them. You know, because they wouldn't let me go to a good school and I didn't have any money and I didn't have any, you know, it was that kind of thing. It was just bratty. Even though we didn't have much, I was always real, you know, sort of like, well, here's ours. And I think back on that, it was kind of unattractive.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? No? All right, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank
you
for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Thank
you. I met a new friend.
All right.
And I will tell you about this place in Long Beach. We're going to California.
Yeah, I
want
to know.
Vintage everything.
Thank you for listening to Discuss 7. Mark Bennett's show is on view until April 7th, 2007. More information on Mark Bennett and Zoe Charlton is available on our website at www.connorcontemporary.com.